Silver sick doesn't help, I said. Tad can help with the silver.
And then we'll send most of them to their own homes, said Adam. Even if our enemy has teeth left, it will take them a while to regroup. For the short term, we should all be safe enough.
Warren grunted, and with my feet safely down on the cement floor, I took a good look at him. Warren was my first friend in Adam's pack. He'd been my friend before he joined the pack. You look better than I expected you to, I said, and to my surprise, he flushed.
Food,
he said with a shy smile. Adam snorted.
Kyle. Well, yes, agreed Warren.
Then his eyes went cold as he tossed the rope ladder back up into the hole in the ceiling.
Mercy, next time you see our favorite bloodsucker, you tell him I owe him one.
I'll tell him, but he did it for Kyle. Warren nodded and hopped on top of the metal shelving that lined the wall so he could close the trap door properly. There were no digs, humorous comments, or even sly looks when Adam, Tad, and I joined the pack in the great room in the basement. I took that as a sign of how bad everyone was feeling. Some of the wolves were notable by their absence.
Daryl and Aurieli went to their home,
Warren told us. He glanced at Adam.
They seemed mostly recovered from the silver, and he is supposed to participate in a conference call with some Chinese scientists on Sunday. All the most dominant wolves seem to be pretty well clean of silver, Tad said.
He told us it's because you used your mate bond to pull the silver out of Adam, and through Adam, the pack, said Honey.
She was sitting on the pool table with her legs crossed underneath her. She was pale, and her mouth was tight, but other than that, she looked mostly like herself.
I didn't believe him until Kyle showed us the silver on the floor.
She frowned at me.
What kind of freak are you?
Any other time I'd have said something cutting. I felt Adam stiffen beside me, and I put my hand on his arm to forestall whatever he wanted to say. Honey had never liked me much, and since I had forced the pack to take a new look at their hierarchy, particularly the way women's ranks were awarded, she'd liked me even less. Honey was as dominant as Peter had been submissive, and a female wolf is supposed to take her rank from her mate. She wanted the role she'd been assigned as his mate, rather than the one that should have been rightfully hers as a dominant wolf. She didn't want to be who she was. She wanted to be delicate and ladylike and feminine. She resented me for challenging that. I wasn't afraid of her. She wasn't the type to take her dislike to the next level and try to kill me. Normally I'd have given her as good as I got, but she just lost Peter. We all had just lost Peter. I am Adam's freak, I told her. Get over it.
Kelly,
Adam said, ignoring Honey altogether.
Come here.
I didn't know Kelly well. I'm not sure anyone did. He was a big, quiet man who worked at a local yard and garden store. He usually had an air of vitality, but now half crept, half stumbled to Adam. Warren grabbed a chair that another wolf vacated without being asked and set it down next to Tad. He pulled Kelly onto the chair and stepped behind him. He reached across the big man's chest and grabbed Kelly's opposite wrist and pulled it tight as he trapped Kelly's free arm, too.
This might hurt, Tad said.
Will hurt, I told Kelly, but I survived it. Kelly's eyes went gold, and he showed me his teeth.
Coyote.
There were still some wolves who resented having a coyote in the pack. I smiled toothily back at him.
Coyotes are tough,
he said. Apparently he wasn't one of the coyote haters. Good to know. So are wolves, I told him.
And both of you talk too much, Tad said. Brace yourself.
He didn't put his hand on Kelly's face, which was smart. Even in human form, werewolves have strong jaw muscles. He touched his forearm just above where Warren held it. Tad's eyes drooped to half-mast, and his nostrils flared, and power burst into being where there had been none a moment before. The scent of fey magic seared my sinuses. Kelly roared, and his whole body arched off the chair. Adam dove to help hold him, and so did Honey, who grabbed both of Kelly's legs in her arms. Tad jerked back. There was a popping noise when his hand came away from Kelly's arm.
I'm sorry, he said hoarsely. I didn't mean for that to happen.
Kelly went limp.
Did you get the silver out? Asked Adam, releasing his hold cautiously, but the werewolf didn't move. Honey dropped Kelly's legs like they were hot and scooted away until she reached the pool table. Warren let go as well. Tad showed him a scant handful of whitish-gray powder. Adam smiled.
Good. Kelly?
The big man shook out his shoulders, took in a breath, and let it out.
I'm good.
He glanced at me.
Thanks for the warning.
No trouble, I said. Mine took longer. He leaned his head to the side without smiling.
Coyotes are tough. Good to know.
Tad drew the silver out of the wolves who needed it, including Ben. Kelly got the worst of it, as Tad's skill improved with practice. When Z's son was finished, Adam sent most of the werewolves back to their own homes where they could protect their families and rest. Honey stayed because he didn't want her too far away from him for a while. Werewolves can get volatile in extreme emotion, and as her alpha, he could keep her from losing control. It was not uncommon for wolves who had lost their mates to have to be killed shortly thereafter. She had changed to her wolf, but otherwise seemed okay. Warren stayed, of course, because it was his home. Ben stayed because he wouldn't go home when Adam told him to. Adam talked to him in private and then let him stay. I think it had something to do with the way Honey watched me when Adam wasn't looking. Once everyone left who was leaving, the house felt like it heaved a sigh of relief. I know I did. Kyle ordered pizza for all who remained, and we were in the middle of eating it when the doorbell rang and a tired-looking Agent Armstrong came in. Jesse and Gabriel took charge of his sisters and hauled them out to the hot tub after determining that Kyle and Warren did indeed have swimming suits of all sizes. Kyle was a divorce attorney, and sometimes his clients and their children needed a safe place to go for a while. That was why his house was so big, and why some of the rooms were Disney-themed and sized for people under 10 years old. Honey was given the job of making sure nothing happened to them. I asked Jesse and Gabriel to make sure that Maya didn't try to ride Honey the way she'd done with Sam. Wide-eyed at the idea, Jesse promised sincerely to do her best. She knew Honey as well as I did, and even on the best of days, Honey wouldn't make a good horsey. Everyone else, Adam called to a meeting in the upstairs theater room. When Armstrong protested all the civilians, looking at Tony and Sylvia, Adam said in a voice that could have frozen a volcano,
"Their presence is non-negotiable."
It wasn't, I thought, so much that Tony and Sylvia's participation was important to Adam, who knew neither one very well. It was that Armstrong had tried to take control of the meeting, and Adam, fresh from being held captive, was not in the mood for it. Adam moved one of the two love seats around so it was in front of the TV before sitting on it at the head of his impromptu council. He didn't bother with his usual charade of human-only strength, having lifted the heavy piece of furniture and carried it by himself with obvious ease. I sat down next to Adam and worried over Armstrong's pale face. We didn't need more enemies. Warren gave Adam a cautious look and settled in the other love seat, pulling Kyle down beside him. Tad had been planning to go out to the swimming pool, too, but Adam had asked him to come after Armstrong protested Tony and Sylvia. At Adam's direction, Tad sat rather uncomfortably on the couch with Tony and Sylvia. There were no more seats in the room. Ben, human again and wearing a set of Kyle's sweats that said, "Taste this rainbow," glanced around and sat on the ground at Adam's feet without a quibble or change of expression. That left Armstrong standing alone. The lack of seats was on purpose, I thought, glancing at Adam's face. He was not happy with Cantrip, and poor Agent Armstrong was the only representative present. Azeel came in late. He glanced at Ben and at Agent Armstrong, who was contemplating the reason for his seatless state. Azeel raised an eyebrow at Adam, though he didn't really look him in the eye, and headed back downstairs. He brought two of the dining room chairs and pointedly set them on either side of Warren's love seat. He took the side that left him as far from Adam as he could get without leaving the room, and, at his gesture, Armstrong took the remaining empty chair.
"You all here know everything Mercy told the police, right?"
Adam said as soon as everyone was seated.
"So let me begin with last night."
For all that we talked about the whole truth and nothing but the truth, Adam's story was edited a little.
He was quite clear on the point that he killed the cantrip agents responsible himself, while I and all the other werewolves in the room knew he lied. He wasn't the only one who had killed, but he was the one responsible. I understood that just fine.
I considered holding them for justice, Adam told us, told me, really. But they had a kill list that included all of the humans associated with my people, children not excepted.
He looked at Sylvia.
Gabriel was on that list. You were not wrong to tell him that his association with us put him in danger.
Maybe not, she said, but I was wrong to expect that to matter to him.
She looked at me, and her lips quirked up.
A friend in danger is not someone who should be deserted. Safety is not always the right path.
They were willing to kill children?
Armstrong asked, not as if he were questioning Adam, but as if he couldn't quite wrap his head around it.
Like Joshua at Jericho, said Adam.
I put my hand on his leg and squeezed it.
They felt that they needed to dig us out, plant root and seed, so that our corruption was truly destroyed. You'll have to accept my word for it, because the whiteboard went up with the winery where we were held.
He paused.
There were three fresh graves in the vineyard that held some of their own people. Maybe they objected. Maybe they just got in the way. We didn't kill them. We didn't kill anyone until our escape. From the state of the bodies, the cantrip agents in the graves died a couple of days before we were taken.
How did they get you all? Asked Azeel.
We thought they were government agents, so we did not initially respond with lethal force.
Adam breathed deeply. But it must not have helped, because he got to his feet and began to pace.
That is a mistake, Agent Armstrong, that we will never make again. You might pass the word along.
For a moment, his menace was such that no one, not even me, dared take a deep breath. He shook his shoulders loose and spoke more moderately.
At any rate, we did not kill or harm anyone when we were taken. So two dead women and the dead man are the responsibility of either the cantrip agents or the mercenaries they hired. If you please, Mr. Hauptmann, said Armstrong. Renegade, cantrip agents. My agency was not responsible for their actions, and both officially and unofficially, we find this business appalling. I just bet you do.
Warren's voice was heavy with rage. Warren was usually the voice of sanity in the pack.
Warren,
said Adam. And Warren looked up, then away.
Do you need to leave?
It was a real question, not a reprimand, and Warren took it the way it was meant.
You need Kyle here, he said, his voice low and his head tipped slightly away from Adam's, in his legal capacity. Not as our lawyer, Adam said, not yet, but his presence is useful, yes. I'd like him to stay. Then I'll stay too. I can deal.
Adam looked at Tony.
I asked Sylvia to come because Gabriel was endangered. I asked you to stay because I do not want to keep the police in the dark about what happened. You are safer if you know everything. However, we cannot afford to let this go to trial in human courts. I will not allow it.
Tony narrowed his eyes.
I am a servant of the law, Adam. There will be hearings, just not in the human court system,
Adam told him.
I answer to a higher power, that power that kept werewolves from being the monsters Cantrip is afraid we are for all the years that humans knew nothing of us. If my actions are deemed excessive, I will pay for them with my life. Those werewolves who killed that pedophile in Minnesota this past spring, they died within a few days of it, all of them. Natural causes, we were told, though their bodies were cremated very quickly and no autopsy was performed,
Armstrong said neutrally, his eyes on me rather than Adam.
A force of nature, anyway, I said obliquely.
Charles was a force of nature, right?
I'm a servant of the law too, Tony, Kyle said, too hastily to be as smooth as his usual redirection. And no one knows better than I how the law and justice do not, cannot, always coincide. I swear to you now that werewolf justice is swifter and more just, if more brutal, than our court system can manage.
He leaned forward earnestly.
We humans are not equipped to deal with a werewolf fairly, and if the police had tried to arrest those men in Minnesota, some of them would have died. I am content that justice will be served in this case.
There was a long pause.
Even if I agree it was self-defense, Tony said. You have just confessed to killing federal agents. I am not qualified to give you a pass on that, Adam.
Agents who attacked law-abiding citizens without provocation, murmured Kyle. Adam is a security expert. I imagine that he has the attack on his house on camera somewhere. Adam grunted.
With nice face shots of several of the cantrip agents, Gutstein informed me tonight. And we have Peter's body.
Where is Peter? I asked.
Safe,
Adam told me.
They buried him in the vineyard next to their own dead. We dug him up, and arrangements are being made.
Suspicious deaths require autopsy, said Tony.
Adam looked at him and nodded.
Yes, we'll talk. There is nothing suspicious about his death. He was murdered right in front of me. He has a bullet hole in his forehead.
No one said anything for a moment after that. The expression on Adam's face might have accounted for the silence.
I have the power to say that Cantrip and the federal government is satisfied that Adam acted in self-defense when he killed those people,
Armstrong said.
Mr. Brooks is right. It would be a political nightmare for Cantrip if the actions of these men were to come out, even though they were not acting in any kind of official capacity.
He took a deep breath.
It would be a similar disaster for the werewolves. In the current climate, I don't know that you could get a judge to declare self-defense, Mr. Hauptmann. If the trial went to a jury, a decision either way could lead to riots and unrest that might break out into open fighting in the streets.
Armstrong looked at something none of us could see, then he met my eyes and held them.
I am a federal agent sworn to uphold the interests of my country. I am a patriot. I have seen fear and hatred cause men and women who have likewise so sworn to forget their oaths and give in to their hatred. I don't want this to go to court.
Tony threw up his hands.
I agree with you, he told Armstrong, both about the self-defense and Adam's chances in court. Though if the case is kept local, I think he would do better than you think. Still, there are bodies. The buried Cantrip agents were shot execution style with the same gun that killed Peter,
Adam said.
You run ballistics?
Asked Tony.
No.
Tony frowned at him.
Then how?
Then he shook his head.
Never mind. But those aren't the only bodies.
Adam's face became even more expressionless.
There will be no other bodies. After we escaped, there was a fire at the winery.
Another silence followed.
I can accept a separate justice, Tony said finally. I've known you. I and my department have called you for help, and you have never failed us. I've seen you meet violence with soft words, and I've never seen you lie. I'm in agreement with Agent Armstrong. I have a few ideas, and I think if Armstrong is willing to help, we can sell this to the department.
You said there was a fire at the winery?
Asked Armstrong. Adam sat down and rubbed his hands over his face.
Yes, we are used to cleaning up our own messes. We found fire to be very effective.
Teeth and the denser bones, said Tony with extreme neutrality, tend to show up after a fire.
I'd be very surprised if there are any teeth or bones, I told him half apologetically. Adam had left Elisaveta out of his explanation. You don't have to worry about that. Armstrong gave me a sharp look, but he didn't say anything further. Instead, he asked,
What about the mercenaries the renegades were working with? Did you identify them?
No,
Adam said.
They're out of it and of no more concern to me. I think there are only three players left.
Azeel held up a finger.
The money man,
he held up another finger.
The turncoat in Senator Campbell's security detail.
And a third.
The person who gave the Cantrip agents the contact information for the mercenaries and the dossiers about your pack and werewolves in general.
I have a friend looking into the information man,
Adam said.
He's pretty sure that he can find the contact name from the mercenaries without causing an international incident.
On Kyle's landline, Adam had been able to get in touch with Charles. Charles was scary good at finding out things no one wanted anyone to know. Charles was just plain scary in general.
But,
Adam continued,
I think the damage the information man can do is done, so there is no great urgency in running him down.
Let's be clear here in this room, said Armstrong. Are you talking about killing him?
Adam shook his head.
Killing him is a lot more problematic than just keeping an eye on him. The past few days aside, we try our best not to go around killing humans, Mr. Armstrong.
You don't consider yourself human?
Asked Armstrong. Azeel raised his eyebrows at Adam, who shrugged and said,
Humans who are not werewolves is too wordy to say more than once. We are as human as we can be.
So we're left with the money man and the potential assassin in Senator Campbell's security team.
Tony was leaning forward intently. Adam leaned back and stretched out his legs. The tension in the room ratcheted down 4 notches, proof that werewolves aren't the only ones who can read body language.
Let's deal with Senator Campbell's problem as the more manageable evil. I've sent word to Senator Campbell through people I know in the security industry, but it might be better, Agent Armstrong, if you warn the senator yourself. Keep in mind that whoever this traitor on his security detail is, he is not necessarily driven by any agenda other than money. If he is only a gun for hire, taking out the Cantrip people who wanted to kill Senator Campbell might be enough to stop him. If he is a zealot of whatever stripe, he's likely to get impatient and try on his own.
Adam paused and raised an eyebrow.
You can tell the senator that I am happy to send a couple of trained security professionals who are werewolves to ensure his safety, if he would allow it. No charge.
Armstrong's mouth quirked.
Have you ever met the senator?
No, sir.
I have. He might just take you up on your offer. He is not as anti-werewolf as he is painted. He just doesn't like it when they go around eating people.
Put like that, he didn't sound so bad, but I'd heard some of his speeches. Adam nodded, but his voice was reserved when he said,
It would please me if he accepted. If something happens to him at this point, it will cause people to blame the werewolves. I'd rather he and his family be safe and sound for years to come.
And that leaves the money man, said Kyle.
Yes,
said Adam. He looked at Armstrong.
Do you have any idea where the money is coming from?
No. Alexander Bennett, he was the man in charge and probably the one who shot your man. Bennett's financials show nothing unusual, and neither do those of any of the people who were likely associated with him. FYI, identifying those people is going to be a nightmare. Looking for people in Cantrip who have problems with werewolves and the current legislation is like looking for cheese in Wisconsin. Bennett just didn't show up for work one day, and there are 2 more like that. One of them had a heart attack and is in the emergency room of a hospital. The other is likely to be ashes here, unless she ran off and got married or something. We have to check out everyone who is working from home, on leave, on vacation, or used to work for Cantrip at some point in time. If you had left the bodies, it would have made that part of my job much easier.
Warren, who until that point had been silent, said,
I have driver's licenses for you. Though we don't have any ID for the people that were buried next to Peter. You'll be able to figure out who they are from their bodies.
Adam looked at him.
If you pardon me, boss, you weren't in any condition to be thinking of things like that. But it occurred to some of us that we might find it useful to know who our enemies are.
He looked at Armstrong.
I'll give you copies and keep the originals.
Armstrong looked as though he'd like to argue, but under Warren's scrutiny, he subsided.
Okay, said Tony. One more thing. Adam, you are going to have to come up with a story to tell the press that will fly with my superiors.
Adam nodded.
Jim Gutstein is going to call in a few favors, and tonight I'll talk to the press out of Kyle's office. I'll take Mercy's story and run with it.
Let me help, said Armstrong. I have some experience in taking scary things and making them ordinary.
This is all well and good, said Sylvia. But you need to explain to me why Maya told me she rode here with a dead body.
That is my fault, Azeel said.
More bodies? Said Armstrong. I thought there weren't any bodies at Sylvia's.
Tony was frowning.
Someone sent a team of assassins after Jesse and Mercy, Tad said, and looked at me. They were waiting for you, Mercy. Now that I've had time to think about it, I think they were in place before I even got to Sylvia's to watch over the kids.
Tad cleared his throat and gave me a sheepish smile.
I felt them when I got there. It's one of the reasons I got close enough that the kids spotted me. After a while, when nothing happened, I figured that there was someone like me living in the apartment complex, half Fae and not required to be in the reservation.
I thought all Fae were required to go,
Armstrong said.
That was our briefing.
Tad shook his head. No, only those deemed powerful enough to be of use. But these assassins, like Agent Armstrong's people, were renegades. The door popped open, and a wet and bright green swimming suit clad Sophia Sandoval flew in.
Mercy! Mercy! Gabriel says come quick! Someone hit your car! Smooshed the trunk!
I was dead. Marsilia was gonna kill me for killing her car. And I didn't really blame her at all. Everyone in the meeting boiled out to look, as much to get out and move than because anyone else was concerned. It wasn't quite 5 o'clock, but this late in the fall, the sun had set while we'd been talking, and the rear of the car was beyond the streetlight. I have good night vision, but even my eyes need a minute to adjust between indoor artificial light and darkness. But it didn't matter, because I didn't get to the car before Gabriel snagged me and pulled me aside with some urgency. He spoke quickly and quietly.
I think we are in real trouble. We just finished getting the kids out of the hot tub in the backyard. Jesse and Mary Jo took everyone else upstairs to dry off and change, but Sophia stayed out to help me put the cover back on the hot tub. We heard a crash and came out front to see what happened. I thought at first someone had just done a hit and run on the car.
He gestured, and I could see the top of the trunk, which had a reverse dent rising from the middle.
I sent Sophia in for you so I could shut the trunk before she saw the body. I didn't see anyone driving off, just a woman on the street. Looked like she was jogging, you know, making good time, too. I thought about heading after her to see if she'd seen anything, but then I noticed just how odd the trunk was, so I took a better look.
He leaned in and said very softly,
"The body was gone, Mercy, and the sound we heard was her hitting the lid of the trunk so she could get out."
All of the werewolves, Azeel, Adam, Ben, and Warren, who had been looking down the street, presumably for whoever hit the car, turned to look at Gabriel and me. Azeel opened the trunk.
"She was dead," he said. "I swear to it. I know she was Fay, but I have killed them before. She was dead. When we walked by here earlier, I could smell the body starting to decompose."
I couldn't help it. I laughed. "Zombie Fay, that's all we needed. I don't know about you, but I'm going to get a really good night's sleep with Zombie Fay running around. I'll go see if I can track her."
"Mercy,"
Adam said. "I won't approach," I promised. "I'll just see where she's going and come back and get you. By the time any of you wolves can change, she'll be long gone." Since young Sandovals were beginning to filter out of the house to see what the excitement was all about, I didn't strip before changing into my coyote. Adam helped me get the sweatshirt off when my coyote self got stuck in it. And only then did I remember that I'd shifted right in front of Armstrong and Tony, neither of whom had known what I was. One of my foster father Brian's favorite sayings had been, "No use crying over spilt milk." Besides, Tad must have used a distraction to get the Fay cuffs out of the trunk, because I caught a glimpse of him slipping peace and quiet under his shirt. So something good came out of it anyway. I put my nose down and was off and running. Azeel was right. She'd begun to rot, and she left a very clear trail. Adam ran beside me in his human form. Apparently he didn't want me out zombie hunting on my own. Coyotes run a great deal faster than people can, and I run faster than most coyotes. Werewolves are good runners, but even a werewolf can run only so fast in their human form. Four-footed travel is a lot quicker than two. He was keeping up with me and moving faster than any human could have, and maybe I wasn't running at my top speed. Not even close, really. Having Adam beside me if I had to confront a zombie Fey assassin was worth slowing down for. Chapter 10. I thought we were going to catch her. It hadn't been 5 minutes since Sophia had broken into the meeting, and how fast could a zombie Fey assassin run? But when we got out to Bombing Range Road, the nearest main thoroughfare, so named because the area had been a bombing range back in World War II, the trail disappeared at the edge of the road. It was full dark, though it was only 6 p.m., but dark doesn't bother me much. I had a clear view in either direction for several miles, and there was no dead woman running along the side of the road. There were, however, a number of cars traveling both directions.
"She got into a car,"
Adam said, trying not to appear winded, as I cast back and forth with my nose to the ground.
"Someone picked her up, or she hitched a ride."
Disturbing to speculate about either way, I thought, but there was nothing we could do about it now. Disturbing was a good word. Of all the things that had happened over the past few days,
A dead Fay getting up and running off might just be the most disturbing. Still, a zombie. Maybe it would intrigue Marsilia enough she'd forget about her car. Not likely, but maybe. I wasn't sure I should feel responsible for the damage to the trunk. How could I have been expected to know that the dead Fay would break out on her own? Adam stared down the road.
If you hadn't slowed down for me, you might have caught her.
Maybe I would have, and maybe that wouldn't have been a good thing. Warren's truck pulled up, and Warren leaned over and opened the passenger door.
No luck?
Warren asked as we hopped in. I took the middle seat.
No, looks like she got in a car. Could have gone either way.
Warren turned the truck around and headed back before he said anything.
That's disturbing,
he said. Zombies or not, the press needed to be appeased. Tony had checked in with his boss and given him the official story that Adam and Armstrong had come up with, which was basically to leave out Cantrip's involvement completely. The conveniently out-of-sight anonymous mercenaries took the majority of the blame. They had been hired to force the werewolves to act in violence and attack Senator Campbell, to get rid of the senator, and to make the werewolves appear to be monsters. Adam didn't look like a monster. He looked like a handsome, charismatic man. He was very good on camera. The person behind the plot apparently panicked when some of his mercenaries were captured while holding Kyle Brooks prisoner. He had them killed to keep them from talking. Armstrong had done some uncleaning to reveal the deaths of the men caught kidnapping Kyle, because it was now a useful part of the story. When they heard about the killings, the other mercenaries left, burning the winery and letting Adam and the pack break free. Officials were trying to find the mercenaries, with an implied fat chance, and the man behind the plot, also fat chance. And hopefully everyone would leave satisfied with nothing but the truth, if not quite the whole truth. So Adam, Tony, Armstrong, Kyle, and Warren headed for Kyle's office in Kennewick by way of Adam's house so he could dress appropriately for a press conference, leaving the rest of us to hold down the fort. The good news was that between the runaway dead woman and the upcoming press conference, no one had said anything to me about the fact that I'd changed into a coyote. Maybe they all assumed I was a half-blood fae, like Tad. When Ben came up to tell me that there was a messenger from Marsilia for me at the front door, I was in one of the upstairs bedrooms reading James and the Giant Peach to the youngest three Sandovals. Kyle's stash of emergency, family-in-need supplies included a big box of books designed to appeal to a wide range of age groups.
"It's just getting to the good part," said Sophia. "We're almost to the giant bugs."
"Can you keep reading?" I asked Sylvia.
"Who is Marsilia?" she asked, taking the book from me.
"The woman who owns the car I've been driving around," I told her. She winced. She'd seen the car.
"Is that the vampire Mercy?"
asked Sissy, who was nearly 7, going on 30.
"Vampires?" Sylvia asked. "There are vampires, too?" And then she said, "You stole a vampire's car and trashed it?"
I winced, too. "Officially, there are no vampires. If you don't believe in them, they will leave you alone. So it's best if you don't believe in them." Maya nodded solemnly.
"My best friend Penny asked me if there were vampires, and I told her no. I did tell her I rode a werewolf, and her mama told me that lying wasn't good. I wasn't lying that time, but sometimes lying is good, right? Mercy, will you come to my house when they come over again and tell them I'm not lying?"
Maya was either going to grow up to rule the world or loose a planet-wide plague upon the land. Maybe both. She had started kindergarten this year, or should have anyway, so we had a little time before we had to look for a place to hide from her.
"You stole a vampire's car?" Sylvia said again.
"Stole is a strong word," I told Sylvia. "It was at my shop for an oil change when trouble hit, and I needed a car that no one could track. It'll be okay, trust me, as long as you don't talk about vampires. They take their secrecy very seriously."
"Mercy," said Maya.
"Okay," Sylvia said. "I'll make sure the children understand."
"Mercy,"
Maya's eyebrows lowered and her voice rose.
"You need to tell Penny's mama so she won't think I'm a liar."
"I will speak to Penny's mama," said Sylvia. "Now hush so I can read about big bugs and rotten fruit."
They hushed.
Ben followed me down the stairs. Azeel and Honey, in her wolf form, were waiting at the base of the stairs. Ben must have told them before he'd gone upstairs to get me. That was okay. It saved me time. I pointed to Honey and said, "Stay out of sight, please. Too many guards says I'm scared of her, which I am, but I don't have to advertise that. It would reflect badly on the pack. Ben and Azeel can come to the door with me because no guard says I don't respect her," which was also true, but not useful. I patted the lamb necklace around my neck to make sure it was still there. Objects of faith worked against vampires, and for me, the lamb worked as well as a cross. Adam had given me a gold with emerald eyes replacement for my silver lamb because wearing silver is problematical when you are the mate of a werewolf. It was just the right size to stay around my neck when I changed, and it was sturdy enough to stay on when I ran. On the same chain, I wore one of Adam's army dog tags. Wedding rings are dangerous for a mechanic. I took a breath and centered myself, as if I were about to enter a match at a dojo. The man waiting on the porch step was a complete stranger, though my nose told me he was a vampire. I didn't know all of Marsilia's vampires by name, but there weren't that many, and most of them I knew by sight. Marsilia was low on powerful vampires. Maybe she'd been recruiting, though I had no way of telling which vampires were more or less powerful than others. This one did not seem like a new vampire. They had less control of themselves. He was Asian, Chinese if I wasn't mistaken, with a lean build. He wore black jeans and a gold silk shirt with a mandarin collar. With the porch light shining directly on him, I could see that it was embroidered with dragons in a gold just slightly darker than the cloth of his shirt. The temperature had fallen with the sun, and if he'd been human, he'd have been shivering in the cold. He'd been changed young, not as young as Wolf, who still looked like a half-grown teenager and had since the Middle Ages. But if the vampire on Kyle's porch had been over 20 when he'd been turned, it hadn't been by much. He bowed his head in greeting, the kind of bow I made before beginning a karate match, with head up and eyes on your opponent rather than the way some of the older European vampires and werewolves do it. I returned his bow the same way he gave it. "I am Thomas Howe, Miss Hauptmann," he said without inflection of accent or emotion. "It is my great pleasure to issue you and your mate an invitation to meet with Marsilia, mistress of the Tri-City Seethe. You may, of course, refuse. I am asked also to inform you that if you come tonight, certain matters may be quickly resolved. She has some information regarding the recent regrettable incidents that she believes would be interesting to you."
"Oh, that's too easy," said Ben, looking at me.
"What does she want?" He spoke quietly, and both he and Azeel had stayed a step farther back in the foyer than I was, so Howe didn't have a clear view of them. That didn't mean he couldn't hear them clearly.
"Do the wolves speak for you, mate of the Alpha of the Columbia Basin Pack?" Howe asked, his voice exquisitely polite.
No. This was not a new vampire.
"I agree with Ben," I said, half apologetically. "I've all but totaled Marsilia's new, very expensive car, and she's just going to forget about it and give me information to top it off? If that's so, why not just a phone call?"
Howe studied me, then looked over his shoulder and took a step back to stare at the Mercedes. He stood there motionless for a few seconds, and when he turned back to me, I was sure I saw amusement on his face, though there was not even a hint of it around his mouth.
"Ah, I do not believe she is aware that the car had been damaged, Miss Hauptmann."
Yes, that was amusement. I folded my arms. Last night I'd have jumped at the chance. Having Marsilia invite me would have given me a slight advantage over inviting myself, as I had planned. But with Adam and the pack back safely, we didn't need the vampires anymore. "I think I'll play it prudent. Tell Marsilia that I'll have the car repaired to her satisfaction and give her a few months to get over it before I visit."
Howe looked at his feet and pursed his lips. "Marsilia is worried, Ms. Hauptmann. We know about the abduction of the pack. The one behind the incident is a danger to everyone in the Tri-Cities, and not just to the Columbia Basin Pack. At a different time, the damage to the car would, I am certain, have just the effect you are concerned about. But Marsilia is old and very, very wealthy. A car is as nothing given what she sees coming. Beside me, Azeel came subtly alert, and I felt it myself. This was a twist I hadn't seen.
"Why doesn't she just use the phone?" I asked.
"Or let you tell us right now," murmured Azeel.
"Because one may be overheard on the phone, and this is dangerous information," said Howe, choosing to ignore Azeel. "Information that may prevent more deaths in your pack." He paused, and again I got the impression he was amused, but no sign of it crossed his face. "Also, because Marsilia dislikes using phones, or," he glanced at Azeel, "surrogates, when she can make you dance to her bidding." That sounded like Marsilia, all right.
Vampires do not breathe except to talk. They do not perspire, and their hearts race only with stolen blood. So it's very difficult to tell when they are lying and when they are telling the truth. I cannot reliably do it.
"Can it wait until tomorrow night?" I asked.
"I believe that you would regret it if you waited," Howe said.
It struck me as odd that he ventured an opinion. I might not be able to tell how old or powerful a vampire was, but I could read subtle cues. This vampire was not anyone's minion. He caught the mistake himself and was more careful as he continued to speak.
"I was to tell you that you should bring Adam and however many of the pack you choose to."
Adam's welcome put a different slant on things. For one thing, it made it less likely that she was setting me up, unless she knew Adam wasn't here right now. It also meant that she probably had a use for the whole pack.
"She wants the wolves to deal with this person so she doesn't have to," I said.
"No," he answered. "No, she will act against him. But matters are more likely to be successful if she and the pack can coordinate their efforts." She was worried, I thought, and so was Thomas Howe.
"Adam is not here at the moment," I told him, "and he wouldn't be for hours."
Howe's mouth tightened.
"That is regrettable."
I was having to rely on body language instead of my nose, but either he was very good at lying with his body, and very few people, vampire or not, are aware enough to do that, or he was dismayed that Adam would not be coming.
"It would still be a good idea," Howe told me, "if you came, Mercy, who is a walker."
A walker is the name given to those of us who are descendants of Coyote, Raven, Hawk, or any of the other archetypes who once walked this land. Vampires do not like us. First, I see ghosts, and ghosts congregate around the daytime resting places of vampires, betraying the presence of the monster who killed them. I am also resistant to a lot of magic, and almost entirely resistant to the standard magic of vampires. When vampires came to the New World, they were met by my kind and nearly destroyed. I think that if disease and war had not decimated the Indians, and thus the walkers, there would be no vampires in the Americas. Of course, being resistant to vampire magic didn't mean I was a match for a vampire in any way, shape, or form. The vampire stared at me with black eyes and waited. Marsilia wasn't going to hurt me. She couldn't afford to, because the werewolves would destroy her if she did. She was just playing games. If I didn't accept her invitation, by werewolf rules, which weren't so different really from vampire rules because both are predators, it would be a coup for Marsilia and a black eye of cowardice for the pack. Being seen as strong and scary kept the monsters at bay. If I showed the world that I was afraid of Marsilia, it made those wolves who belonged to the pack that much less safe. I could insist on waiting until Adam got back. That might make me look weak, but it wouldn't reflect much on the pack. Adam had had less than an hour's worth of sleep since he escaped, and I was pretty sure he hadn't slept otherwise since before the pack was taken. I was tired, too, and wanted nothing more than to go back upstairs and read about giant squishy fruit with the Sandoval girls. We had lost Peter, and I didn't want to lose anyone else, no matter how much the vampires scared me. Waiting for Adam, when I knew Marsilia wouldn't hurt me, really was cowardice. Adam was exhausted, and this was something I could do for him and for the pack.
"All right," I said. "I'll come. I have matters to arrange first if I'm going to go. I can find my way to the Seethe."
Howe shook his head.
"The mistress asked me to make sure that you made it there safely. I will wait here."
"It might take me a while," I warned him. He bowed again. I am used to waiting.
Your decision, I told them, then closed the door. I looked at the werewolves and waited for their reactions. Aziel gave Dick and Jane, the nude statues that adorned Kyle's foyer, an amused look.
I like the hat, he said.
Which one? I asked. Jane had a new hat this month, a straw cowboy hat with an ostrich feather pointing jauntily up, just like the first 10 inches or so of the ski hat Dick wore somewhere south of his belly button. The long tail of Dick's hat drooped down until its pom-pom end hung just below Dick's knees. Aziel's amusement turned into a real smile, an open and beautiful smile that made him look 25 instead of how many hundreds of years old. Kyle has Christmas wear for them, I told him. He usually dresses them up the day after Thanksgiving, but he's been a little too busy to get them rigged out.
You aren't really going to go, right?
Asked Ben. Marsilia isn't going to hurt me, I told him. He rolled his eyes.
Have you seen what you did to her car?
Peter died, I told Ben. Go find Tad and tell him that you two will be watching this house tonight. His chin rose. I'm not taking Tad into the vampire den, I told him. And honey should not be left guarding the kids, not tonight. Not when Peter had just died and she might lose control of her wolf. Honey padded into the foyer, graceful, golden, and beautiful. She snarled at me. I am the boss of you, I told her as I headed for the stairs. You're coming with Aziel and me, so put a sock in it.
Does the whole pack follow your orders so well, little coyote?
Aziel asked, amused. Yes. He laughed again. I gave him a cool look. Or they regret it for a long time. We hadn't had a chance to resupply on cell phones yet, and that left me with no direct way to contact Adam. The first rule of being married is to communicate where you are going and why. I called Tony, and Sylvia answered. Tony had left his cell phone with her. Kyle's phone went straight to voicemail. I left a message on it and stopped to think. Armstrong probably had a cell, but I didn't have his number. I called Kyle's office from the landline and told the recording that I was going to meet with Marsilia, but didn't dare to get more specific than that. I called Stefan. He didn't answer his cell phone, and no one answered his home phone. I left more detailed messages both places. When I set the phone on the counter, Aziel and Tad were both in the kitchen. Tad looked at Aziel.
Mercy needs clothes to wear if she's going to face Marsilia. Stay here because I want to talk to her.
Aziel gave me an amused glance, Tad a less amused glance, but didn't protest waiting while Tad escorted me up the stairs and into the bedroom that he'd been sleeping in. He took out the odd chunk of metal from his pocket and invoked the sword his father had made.
I already destroyed the cuffs, he told me, holding it out, so I don't need it. I'm not a swordsman, and you're going into enemy territory dangerously unarmed. I don't know, Aziel, and honey doesn't like you. You may need something.
Aziel is Brand's. He will defend me, I told him. I didn't take the sword. I've had some weapons training in karate class, but I've also read the stories about the dark smith of Drontheim.
Which is more than you can say about honey, Tad groused. Maybe you should take me.
I shook my head. I don't want to leave either Honey or Aziel with the kids. Honey might lose it and kill someone. I'd rather it be the vampires than the kids. Aziel is not entirely stable. If something does happen here and he had to kill someone, it could be worse than Honey losing it. This visit with Marsilia shouldn't be dangerous, if Ha was not lying. Can you discern lies? Some they could, some couldn't, though they themselves could not lie.
Not with vampires, he admitted.
Vampires are tricky, I agreed, instead of saying me either. But I think Hal was serious about Marsilia taking action, which makes me suspect that we are dealing with something that directly threatens the vampires after all. She wouldn't stir herself on our behalf unless there was something big in it for her. That, I think, kept it from being a lie. If he thought I could read Hal's truth, he'd be less likely to argue. But I was pretty sure Hal had not been lying. Who gains, Aziel had asked me, if the pack is gone from the Tri-Cities? Not Marsilia, I'd assured him, because Marsilia benefited from our pack. No one wanted to take on Adam, and because Marsilia and Adam had cooperated a time or two, people thought that we cooperated more with the vampires than we really did. Adam didn't object, because he felt it kept the riffraff out. But that meant one of her enemies might come after the pack in order to weaken her. She'd already withstood one attempt to take over her territory, and we of the Columbia Basin Pack had supported her. "I should be safe enough," I told Tad. "Honey might not like me much, but she is loyal to Adam, and she is impressive. And of the werewolves we have here, she's the single best fighter. I need you here. You'll take care of the children first and foremost. Ben is good for defense if you need it, but I don't know how he'll be around kids." With his four-letter vocabulary and his anger problems, I'd have normally avoided leaving him with children or undefended women. But he was loyal to Adam, and I was confident that he wouldn't hurt any of the kids, even if he might expand their vocabulary in unfortunate directions. "All right," Tad said, "all right, but you take the sword." He held it out again. It looked wicked and wrong in a room filled with Thomas the Tank Engine's cheery presence. I made no effort to take it. "I know about your father's swords," Tad laughed.
"Yeah, there was a long period of time when Dad was pretty angry with the world. This one is called hunger, and it needs to taste your blood. Then it will serve you, until it tastes another's blood it likes better. I know you've done some weapon forms in karate, but you're right. It's still better not to use it unless you have to. You'll never know when it might prefer someone else, and since you aren't Fae, it will be even less inclined to stay with you. However, it will kill vampires in a way a normal sword cannot. It will also eat magic, items or spells, though from my experience it is pretty slow." He looked at me. "And there's still that Fae assassin running around when she should be dead. I don't know for sure that this sword will do anything to her, but it's more likely to incapacitate her than a knife, a bullet, or even a werewolf is." He held the sword out again, and I took it gingerly. "Use it to cut yourself to bind it to you. I'd recommend forearm or calf, and be careful. It's really, really sharp."
So I touched my left forearm to the blade, and it zapped me a good one as it sliced into the skin. It felt like magic turned to electricity, like touching a hot wire on a fence. Tad frowned.
"That's not supposed to happen. Let's try this."
He pulled out a pocket knife and cut his index finger. He got a few drops of blood flowing, then pressed his finger on the still bleeding cut on my forearm. I winced and winced again when he took hold of my hand that held the sword and guided it to taste of our mingled blood. This time there was no zap of magic, but a gentle dance of power through my body.
"That's better," he said. "Now you should be able to sheathe the blade just by thinking about it."
He was right. In an instant, the blade had vanished, leaving what looked like a random lump of pitted metal. "If the Grey Lords were mad about the walking stick," I said. The lump of metal's residual magic made my forearm buzz all the way to my elbow.
"Let's just say that it would be better if you give it back to me as soon as you return, and I intend to give it back to my father at the earliest opportunity. This isn't like peace and quiet. Hunger is a major artifact, and the Fae Lords won't be happy to find that it is in your hands, particularly as you gave another Fae artifact to Coyote."
I jerked my head up to look him in the eyes, and he grinned.
"Dad told me. He had to tell a few of the Fae because they knew you had the walking stick, and they wanted it back in the worst way."
I started to put it into the pocket of Kyle's sweats when Tad stopped me.
"You aren't really going to wear those to meet with Marsilia, are you?"
"Right," I said. "I'll go look in Kyle's closet." Kyle's closet yielded a pair of jeans that were tight but not unbearably so, and a blue sweater that Tad picked out. I hoped I wasn't stealing Kyle's favorite clothes. I got downstairs, and Honey, still in wolf form, and Azeel waited for me. Azeel handed me a coat. It was a good coat, and it fit. More importantly, it had a pocket big enough for the Fae artifact that was sometimes a sword, so I didn't have to keep it stuffed in the too tight jeans. Azeel drove Warren's truck with Honey beside him. She wasn't happy about that, but I didn't like her any more than she liked me. That she was mourning Peter, whom I liked very much, just made me more uncomfortable around her. Let Azeel deal with her, and vice versa. I drove Marsilia's Mercedes. We take the truck back and leave the car with Marsilia. That would get it out of my hands, and anything else that happened to it would be her fault. Tad had had to bend the trunk more to get it to latch. Now the trunk looked like a tree had fallen on it, which didn't improve the car's appearance at all. I'd moved my gun from the car to the truck, but I planned on leaving it there. If I was reduced to shooting at the vampires tonight, I might as well shoot myself and get it over with. Thomas Howe led the procession in an inconspicuous white Subaru Forester with California plates. I thought we were going to the Seethe right up until he turned in the wrong direction at the Keene roundabout, taking us away from the Tri-Cities. I hesitated, driving an extra round on the roundabout. If he was from out of town, as the California plates indicated, he might have gotten lost. When I could see him again, the vampire had pulled to the side of the road and was waiting for us. If he'd taken a wrong turn, he'd figure it out when we ran out of town and ended up out in the countryside, I decided. If not, then I'd guess we were meeting Marsilia somewhere else. It didn't make me happy, but I wasn't unhappy enough to turn back to Kyle's. I pulled out behind Howe, and Aziel followed me. When he drove past the big hayfields without slowing, then turned to take us farther out into West Nowhere, I figured that we weren't going to the Seethe and took out Gabriel's sister's phone, which I still had, and called Sylvia on Tony's phone. "We're not going to Marsilia's," I told her. "We're out on Highway 224 headed toward Benton City. I'll give you another call when I know more."
"I'll keep the phone nearby," she said.
20 minutes later, we were through Benton City and headed up on the bluffs that overlooked the Yakima River, surrounded by orchard and vineyard. I hadn't seen a house in miles when Howe turned up a gravel road between rows of orchard trees. I'd spent the entire time thinking about vampires. Old vampires had money. Marsilia had been going through a fugue, old vampire version of depression, from what I'd gathered. She had sat around not doing much for years, and that made her look weak, which is why Gauntlet Boy had attempted to steal her Seethe. Marsilia would never so much as blink unless it benefited her. She wouldn't arrange a meeting with the pack unless she needed help. This, all of this, had begun with the vampires. The more I thought about it, the more sense it made. Of course a vampire would kill the mercenaries who might know too much. He wasn't scared of what they might say to the police. He was scared of what they would say to Bran or Charles. If the pack died, and he'd intended them to die, probably couldn't believe that they'd let themselves be taken by a handful of mercenaries and cantrip agents, then the Maroc would hunt down the responsible parties. The trees fell away first, then the gravel, and we crawled through what seemed like acres of grapes that looked deader than could be attributed to the season alone. Marsilia's car was a city car, and wasn't too happy with the rocks and ruts that had replaced the gravel. Vampires gained powers. Stefan could teleport, and that was a real secret because it made him a target. James Blackwood, the master of Spokane, could steal the abilities of the supernatural folk he fed upon. Maybe this vampire could create a zombie from my assassin. Why anyone would want to was another matter. I was so lost in my thoughts that it wasn't until I got a good whiff of smoke that I figured out where we were going. The smoke itself wasn't unusual. This time of year a lot of places burned agricultural rubbish, but this smelled like a house fire and not just burning plant matter. Hastily, I called Sylvia again. "Tell Adam we're going to the place where he was kidnapped and held."
"Is something wrong?" she asked.
"Not necessarily," I said, though I was suspicious that Howe had been so careful not to tell me that we were meeting at the winery Adam and Elisaveta had burned to ash. "She might have something to show me here." Or maybe not. Maybe I'd just been really, really stupid. I took a breath. "Tell Adam that I didn't recognize the vampire who brought us here. He says his name is Thomas Howe, and he drives a Subaru Forester with California vanity plates that say, Daytime." I spelled it for her. On a vampire's car, the plates could mean anything from irony to hope. "Could be this isn't Marsilia's gig at all," I said, not liking that thought either.
"I'll tell them."
I hung up the phone and continued to follow the vampire. We came upon the burnt remains of the winery from the backside, the final confirmation of my suspicions. The fire had burned hot, leaving only stone, cement, and just a few shards of very black wood behind. Elisaveta had been thorough in this, as in everything else she did. The waxing moon, three-quarters full, gave the remains a horror movie eeriness, as did the ghost waiting next to the vineyard on the opposite side of the dirt track we were following. Seeing ghosts was not unusual, and that one wasn't the only ghost hovering about. I would not